Good morning. Isn't that a cheerful topic for a sermon, humility? Somebody grimaced when I came in today and said, what are you talking about? I said, humility. So I know it's a little bit, maybe not quite as inviting as it might be. So let's see what we can do to help that. I want to read to you a few lyrics from a song by Peter Mayer. He's the guy who wrote Blue Boat Home. And I want to start with this image of who we are as human beings. He talks about, he sort of is setting us up as being something special within the world, within the universe. He talks about clouds and rocks and mountains. And then he continues this. Waves are crashing, rivers churning, planets twirling, stars ablaze. Storms are raging, atoms whirling, and you, my child, are awake to perceive these wondrous things, to count the beats of a blackbird's wings, to tell a story and dance and sing. All the splendors of creation are very happy that you came because they needed someone to see them, and you, my child, are awake. It's a lot more inspiring with his guitar work behind it, son. But I want you to hold on to that sense of us as we are the creatures who can see the others. We see and appreciate and tell stories and laugh and sing and dance. Because I want us to think about humility. And just who do we think we are? So this may not be my most inviting sermon title ever. You have that first line, you know, which to me anyway evokes things I've heard people say throughout my life. You know, who does he think he is? Who does she think she is? Who do you think you are? When you hear those kinds of phrases, usually you assume that there's some negative judgment going on in the background, right? It's often dismissive. It's really not a move to engage with curiosity or compassion or understanding. We don't really want to know who he thinks he is. We just want him to get out of the way, right? It suggests that the person or persons in question have misunderstood their place or their proper status. Maybe it's suggesting they don't have the proper level of humility, right? Traditionally, that phrase, who do you think you are, is meant to be a put down. And I'm wanting us to think today about we, because we're all in this, all sorts of different thises. We're in this together. We are both individuals and we're connected in kinship and community. So who do we think we are? And what does humility have to do with that? So there's this word, humility. Let's talk about that a little bit. It's a difficult word, and I think perhaps it's especially difficult for feminists, as it's tended in many cultures to be a characteristic expected or even demanded of women, with very harsh judgment attached to a perceived lack of humility. And the word humility itself often brings to mind humiliation, which is defined in the dictionary as a painful loss of pride, self-respect, dignity, or honor. It also brings us to the word humble, because the dictionary definition of humility is the condition of being humbled, of being humble. But the word humble is also used as a verb, as in, I'm gonna humble him. Or this army humbled that army. And in that sense, humble means to destroy someone's independence or power or will. But to go back to humility as the condition of being humble, I want to go now to the adjectival definition of humble. Humble as an adjective. What does it mean? And if you look in the dictionary, you get an interesting jumble of meanings and synonyms. You get meek, submissive, subservient, low. These are all kind of icky. But you also get not proud or arrogant, and you get unpretentious or unpretending. That's a little more interesting. To be humble is to not pretend. It's to be real, to be authentic. You also get modest, and I have to admit this is another feminist trigger word. But modest, if you look it up in the dictionary, means having a moderate estimate of one's merits or importance, moderate self-regard. It means to be free of ostentation. It means, here we go with, again, this applies to women more than men too often, having regard for decency. That has special overtones for women and how we choose to dress or walk or talk or just about anything. So eye rolls here. But you come back to these definitions and you also have the possibility of modest meaning limited or moderate in amount or extent. You have synonyms, unpretentious, retiring. Unpretentious, that could be good. Retiring, unassuming, virtuous. Somehow we always worry more about women's virtues than men do, I think, sometimes. So again, we're talking about humble and all these different meanings. If you go back to the Latin, the English humble comes from Latin, humilis. And it means, in my dictionary says it means lowly or insignificant, but literally it is on the ground, which could mean I humbled him and laid him out flat on the ground. You're being knocked down, pushed down, overcome, defeated. But it doesn't have to. It comes from the word humus, which means earth. Okay? And earth, actually the word humus itself, not just through humble, but just as from itself, came into modern English from the Latin. And it is the dark organic material in soils produced by decomposition of vegetable or animal matter and essential to the fertility of the earth. Okay, so that's kind of a neutral thing. It's kind of cool, you know, how do things grow? How do we plant things and they grow? It's because they have humus. So with such a range of definitions, overtones, and associations in play with the word humility, I think it's important to pay attention when that word is being used, and especially when it's being used prescriptively, which I'm clearly doing in my title. I'm going to say humility is a crucial value, i.e. go get yourself some. So when you hear people saying you need humility or you need to be humble, I'm saying we need to pay attention to how people are using the word and what they mean. So what I'd like to do this morning is to choose carefully, but not randomly, from among this buffet of meanings that the word could have. I do want to argue that humility is a crucial attitude for us. And by us, I mean Unitarian Universalists. I mean Americans. I mean human beings. And I want to argue that it's crucial for us to cultivate at this time in our history. This is a time of discouragement, of Me Too, of environmental crisis. It's also spring. You know, there's splendors out there to observe, to tell stories about. I do not want to propose that we understand humility as having anything at all to do with humiliation or the loss of dignity or self-respect. I do not mean here an attitude of self-effacement or submission or being or feeling inferior. Instead, I'd like us to build or grow an idea of humility from the ground up, if you will, with reference to the ancient Latin root of the word for earth. Humility, then, is above all grounded, essential to life, and productive of growth and fertility. And I didn't know that it was Stewardship Sunday when I wrote all that, but I didn't know we were going to sing the garden song. This all kind of fits. Understanding someone or something to be on the ground, understandably, leads to the idea of inferiority if we unthinkingly accept certain common cultural biases, such as the idea that lower is worse than higher, that ground or earth or matter is less important or less good than heaven, spirit, intellect, that striving to get ahead of someone else, to succeed at the cost of someone else's failure, to rise above someone else's level, is laudable. If you buy into those biases, then understanding something or someone being on the ground becomes a negative. It leads to an idea of inferiority. But we can choose to understand humility from the ground up, as standing in our own connection to the ground, literally and figuratively. This is humility in the sense of a modest opinion or estimate of one's own importance or rank. And by modest, I mean to say moderate, balanced, unpretending. In other words, true humility is simply the art of knowing who we are. Self-knowledge without striving to appear or to be better or worse than we are or than others are. It is, I think, akin to the searching and fearless moral inventory of the fourth step in 12-step programs. This isn't to discount the possibility or desirability of becoming better. It's just an accurate assessment of our starting point and current position or state of being. Humility is reasonably accurate self-knowledge. Humility really is about who we think we are. And human knowledge, of course, is always incomplete and provisional. And since the truth of our lives can be both delightful and painful, courage and curiosity are important allies and strategies. So I want to ask, who do we think we are? And I want to say again that when I say we, I mean lots of different things. I mean Amy and I talking, we're a we. I mean, having the conversation during second hour, those are we's. This congregation is a we, Unitarian Universalists, citizens of the United States of America, residents of the United States of America. There's lots of we's, and I mean all of them at different points. And when we talk about who do we think that we are, there are so many different ways to think about that. And you'll think about it and be interested in different ways than I am. I want to note that I find it kind of difficult to discuss these different levels separately because, again, we're all connected. Everything's connected. But I also think the way that we understand who we are, individually and collectively, seems to change very fast these days. It seems to me it's a bit of a challenge to understand anything with balance and moderation, with the amount of just information, let alone opinions, that come at us so quickly. I do think that our first and seventh principles are good guides, good starting places for this, as they are for many things. And so our first principle is the worth and dignity of every human person, which we, as the you we, is thinking. We're in a process of discernment. Is that worth and dignity just about human beings, or is it about other beings as well? Do we need to expand how we think about that? But worth and dignity. So any understanding of who I am that depends upon or implies or results in denigrating the worth and dignity of others is a questionable understanding, right? And then the seventh principle, which is respect for the interconnected web. It's just, we are all connected. So again, we need to understand within those parameters, if you will. I've been reading a theologian and ethicist, Wendy Farley, who is Christian, but carries that, and the Christian terminology, rather mindfully, actually. She's clearly formed by Buddhism as well as Christianity. She suggests that we do well to resist both the impulse to judge ourselves and others as guilty and the impulse to divide humanity according to some scheme by which some are right and others are rejected. So this reminds me of Brian Stevenson's powerful Ware lecture at the UUA's General Assembly last year. Some of you have heard me mention it before. In that lecture, he noted how much more difficult justice work and truth-telling are made by our culture's punitive tendencies. The need to lay blame and impose punishment keeps us from true humility, I think, from being able to tell our stories and understand who we are and how we have been with each other. If we can't see ourselves and hear each other, it is very difficult to imagine a way forward. This ingrained tendency that both Stevenson and Farley have pointed to, this ingrained tendency to divide people into guilty and acceptable, is driven, I think, by our own fears that we are not worthy. It's also a temptation to expend never-ending effort in the project of vindicating ourselves by proving we are better, more acceptable than the guilty are. It's an opportunity to miss the value of humility from both ends at once. Humility, I think, can be an invitation to give up that project of figuring out who's guilty, who's not guilty, who's better, who's worse, and to accept with grace and compassion a realistic, modest self-concept. So I found a quotation attributed to Rumi, but just kind of like a couple places on social media, and I couldn't really track it down. So with the caveat that this may or may not actually be Rumi, but it feels Rumi-esque to me, and it's fun, it goes this way. Each one of us is a jackass with wings of angels tacked on. And this makes sense. This sounds like a humble assessment of the human person. It's perhaps an idea of humanity and our own humanity that we can work with. We can make allowances for the jackass and look for ways to strengthen the wings and practice rising. Clearly, we are both vulnerable and prone to pretending that this is not so. Humility asks if we dare stop pretending and instead understand ourselves as both gifted and limited. And lest you think, there's a vast literature on humility in Western philosophy, probably, and in other places too. But this isn't just a sort of philosophical, religious, mystical kind of thing. It's also starting to be shown up in some of the social sciences. In the United States, the New York Times published an article in December by Kristen Wong that was entitled "Why Self-Compassion Beats Self-Confidence." And it was kind of a more current, an updated response to the idea of self-esteem that was so well studied, and people had so many, I don't know how many foundations there were to raise self-esteem in children, and how many schemes there were in the schools to help children. I'm not trying to knock self-esteem, but the study is suggesting that self-compassion, which is not just about talking up, learning how to talk up yourself or increase your self-confidence, but that self-compassion, which is an understanding of who one is and an ability to accept mistakes as part of the process of growing, might actually have better outcomes for people in life. And I don't remember how this study was set up, but I thought it was interesting. It's like, oh, here, we have evidence, because evidence is everything, right? We have evidence that maybe we should be all thinking along the lines of self-compassion. Humility invites us, as I've said, to see ourselves as neither more nor less than we are, neither more nor less beautiful and valuable than other beings. Wiser folks have always aimed for this moderation in self-understanding. There's an old saying, you know, pride goeth before a fall. I think that comes out of the Bible. I used to know. I think it's in Proverbs. And there's this idea also that runs through many of our traditions that false humility, self-effacement, denial of our own power is dangerous too. It might even be immoral. Feminist ethicists especially have played with this for decades. This idea that failing to be the self that you are is an issue of ethics, even. Parker Palmer, who's a Quaker, but above all, he's a very wise writer and teacher and activist. He's written a lovely little book about vocation entitled Let Your Life Speak. It's one of my favorites, really. I don't think the book has the word humility in it at all. It may be hiding, but it's really not the subject of the book. But I find that book to be largely an extended meditation on precisely that the subject of knowing oneself. And it's eloquent on the importance of finding one's own unique path, the path of what he calls true self, the reality of our own nature, which means our limits as well as our potentials. And he writes this, and I'm quoting, "If we are unfaithful to true self, we will exact a price from others. We will make promises we cannot keep, build houses from flimsy stuff, conjure dreams that devolve into nightmares, and other people will suffer if we are unfaithful to true self." This rings true for me, whether we are over or underestimating ourselves. Palmer also describes a particularly interesting way in which we can be less than truthful in our orientation to ourselves and the world. He labels it functional atheism, which is a useful label for his context, which is largely Christian. It's less useful in our context because we don't assume belief in God, within our communities, and we also don't necessarily think theism is to be pursued and atheism to be avoided. So we have to kind of set that aside. Nonetheless, I think his idea of functional atheism, I haven't been able to come up with a better term for it, it makes a lot of sense without reference to divinity. And I'd like to note it as one form of a lack of humility, what he describes as functional atheism, which I'm going to read you his definition in a second. I think it's a failure to correctly estimate our importance. And he says this, functional atheism, for Palmer, is the belief that ultimately responsibility for everything rests with us. This is the unconscious, unexamined conviction that if anything decent is going to happen here, we are the ones who must make it happen. And he continues a little bit later, ours is not the only game in town. Not only are there other acts out there, but some of them are even better than ours, at least occasionally. We learn that we need not carry the whole load, but can share it with others, liberating us and empowering them. We learn that sometimes we are free to lay the load down altogether. The great community asks us to do only what we are able and trust the rest to other hands. Elsewhere, Palmer, again not talking about humility, but I'm reading his words and taking them as if he were, quotes from Florida Scott Maxwell, who says, "You need only claim the events of your life to make yourself yours. When you truly possess all you have been and done, you are fierce with reality." And Palmer, reflecting on that quotation from Scott Maxwell, says, "Today at age 76, I know Scott Maxwell got it right. There are no shortcuts to wholeness. The only way to become whole is to put our arms lovingly around everything we've shown ourselves to be, self-serving and generous, spiteful and compassionate, cowardly and courageous, treacherous and trustworthy. We must be able to say to ourselves and to the world at large, I am all of the above. If we can't embrace the whole of who we are, embrace it with transformative love, we'll imprison the creative energies hidden in our own shadows and flee from the world's complex mix of shadow and light." Which brings me to the larger-than-self sort of humility we need to grapple with. And this is the we part. Because as profound as an exploration of the true self can be, and Parker Palmer especially is very profound, I think, our practices of humility must, and I think really simply they just must, extend beyond the individual and beyond our comfortable local communities. UU principles and sources point us this way. We talk about justice and democracy and equity and developing and growing those things and supporting them wherever we find them in the world. And I've been reading a lot of UU history lately, and so I've been reminded afresh that our successes in extending humility outward are fitful and uneven. Here, too, that we have the temptation to believe in isolation and disconnection. We have misunderstandings of autonomy, and we have repeated failures of inclusion. And yet, we are all web dwellers. We're embedded, we're enmeshed, we're held in the web of all existence. We celebrate this. And those problems in communities and systems and institutions and ecosystems and Gaia, the earth, we're embedded in all of that. And I think I have this sentence here that's really lovely, but I don't know how it connects to the one before it. Sorry. We, as a Unitarian Universalist community, we demand a fearless search for truth, right? Potentially, that ends in delight and awe and fascination and wonder. And it also ends in a humble acknowledgement of who and what we are and how we have behaved and misbehaved. Undertaking that project of looking at ourselves in humility requires a stiff dose of compassion for the beauty and the tragedy of what is. Farley writes, quote, "The world is not only dangerous, but also unbearably beautiful. We face the impossible task of opening our spirits ever wider to beauty, friendship, love, and knowledge while protecting ourselves from assault and danger." End quote. Leaning into the humility of knowing and accepting ourselves and our situation is, we should be clear, leaning into that is the only way to wholeness, health, and hope. But Farley reminds us that we should understand that we're leaning into power when we do that. We're not leaning into impotence or passivity or neurotic patience, self-sacrifice, or the evacuation of our personhood. And that list I'm quoting from her. So power is our birthright. And to know that and embrace it is also part of humility, and not something we are free to renounce when the way gets tough, when we come into conflict with others searching for their true place in the world. And because I want to stop, I'm just going to refer you to a wonderful chapter of On Being on their website. They have one called In Defense of Backtalk, which it's a wonderful, I think you can listen to it or read it. I read it. But Miguel Clark Mallet talks about the gift of hearing people who aren't being polite, but they have important truths to bring. And it's really good. And if we want, I can read it during the discussion afterwards. But I'm going to wrap up by saying, so given all of this and trying to hold it all at once, who do I think we are? I think we are the ones who are awake to perceive the splendors of creation. We are the ones who love and rage and desire. We are the ones who are smaller and less significant than we might wish we were, and also more powerful than we have dared to hope. We are the ones who struggle to receive the words that are hard to hear from those among us who can help us see in all humility just who we really are. And we are all of the above, and so much more. So taking a few liberties with familiar words by Wayne Arneson, I want to leave you with this. Take courage, friends. The pursuit of humility is not for the meek. Take courage, friends. The way is often hard. The path keeps shifting, and the stakes are very high. Take courage, for deep down there is another truth. You are not alone. May it be so.